From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on May 31st, 1921, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Maybe you know this story, or maybe, like millions of Americans, you don't. Tulsa was home to a thriving black community, sometimes referred to as home of a Black Wall Street. A white mob erupted in violence, shooting, firebombing, attacking, torching homes and businesses. A teenager was hiding in a bathtub when the mob attacked. Ed Goodwin was, like many kids in Tulsa in 1921, hopeful for the future, probably proud of how the community was thriving. In just hours, it would be torched, literally 35 blocks, torched and trashed. The estimates on the dead varied, as many as 300 murdered in a campaign of racially motivated aggression. Journalist Victor Lukerson called it an attempt to, quote, smother a spark of black independence. And it had been boiling under the surface. There was evidence that the government provided some of the weapons used by the mob. As Lukerson notes, the local newspaper, the Tulsa Democrat, had called it an indignity to make white people live beside a growing black population. And then, in a streak of violence, hundreds were dead and Tulsa was burning. How much do you know about this story? Many American schools don't teach it at all. As NPR reports, there's been some controversial statements, even from Oklahoma's superintendent of public instruction, Ryan Walters, about the massacre. When he first took the job, he waffled on whether it is even acceptable to teach about the Tulsa massacre. That's his state. So maybe it was no surprise that many white people are starting to ask why. Why haven't they been taught? And last year, you might have seen actor Tom Hanks' op-ed he wrote on exactly this subject. He was then interviewed on the Enscape podcast, and I want to listen to some of what Tom Hanks said there.
I will tell you, I read a New York Times piece on a 100-year-old survivor of the Tulsa massacre. And my question was this: what's the Tulsa massacre? You know, I was taught American history every 3 years growing up. Fifth grade, eighth grade, 11th grade. And then I studied in junior college, and I've read it ever since for pleasure. How is it that it wasn't until 2 years ago that I heard about the Tulsa massacre? How is that possible? I've heard about Custer's Little Bighorn. I heard about the Alamo. I heard about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. You know, I heard about all kinds of disasters in which people died. But I had never heard about this thing that happened in 1921, only 3 years before my dad was born, in the same year that Donna Reed was born. We didn't hear about this thing that happened in which essentially one of the most successful black communities in America, Black Wall Street, in which everybody was not only burned out of their homes and their businesses, but then driven out of the city limits by an angry mob of, I'm sorry, white people. How is it that this was not taught to me? Because I tell you, at the age of 10, when I was in fifth grade, living in Oakland, California, that would have been a moment of enlightenment for me that would have told me something very, very different about the city I lived in. Not just American history or the city of Tulsa. And it made me mad. It made me mad that somebody had somehow made an editorial process of what was appropriate for us to learn about our own American history. It made me angry that it took until I was, I'm 60, I'll be 66, just about 2 weeks after Juneteenth, I'll turn 66. And it took me 54 years in order to find this out. It's not right. It's not right, and it's doing a disservice to all of America in order to not point out some very, very simple, and I meant, dare I say it, facts that can be accepted. I don't want to overuse the word dispassionately, but it can be used dispassionately. That's what happened. Nobody alive today is guilty over of it. Nobody alive today is to blame for it, except perhaps the people who said, let's not talk about that.
That's Tom Hanks on the Enscape podcast last year. Now, in the past week, NPR has reported on new developments in the case for justice being carried on by the two remaining survivors of the Tulsa massacre. Their case was originally carrying three plaintiffs, Lessie Benningfield Randall, Viola Fletcher, and Hughes Van Ellis. They were 109, 108, and 102 years old when they went to court last year. Van Ellis passed away in the fall after a judge in Oklahoma dismissed their case. They are appealing and seeking damages from the state, and they say that their case is a chance for some symbolic justice, even 103 years later, the Oklahoma Supreme Court will have its say on that. All of which brings us to a book from journalist Victor Lukerson. It's called Built from the Fire, the epic story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street. His book was named to the New York Times Notable Books list of 2023. He spoke to students this morning at RIT. He'll have an event tomorrow at 11 a.m. at the Rochester Public Library on South Avenue. It is open to the public. Victor Lukerson, welcome. Thank you for making time for the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Evan.
There's a lot of different directions to go here. I just want to ask you how your talk was with students this morning at RIT. We'll start there.
Oh, I loved it. You know, I might become a professor one day, I think. I really enjoyed talking to students. I've been on an academic book tour, actually, since September. And in particular, this is a public history course at RIT. And what I've done is really sort of putting public history to practice. So it was great for me to be able to sort of relay my knowledge and also to feel like the students were getting something out of it, too. It was really great.
You want to describe for listeners when you decided that this book needed to be written and how you decided you wanted to go about doing that?
Of course. So I'm actually a business reporter by training, and I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, before this process began. And I was actually having a lunch with one of my high school friends. He's a young black entrepreneur. And the film 12 Years a Slave came up, actually. My friend had never seen the movie. Say he didn't really want to see the movie because he was tired of only seeing black folks being brutalized in pop culture depictions. I asked my friend, have you ever heard of Black Wall Street? He had never heard of it, this story about black success. And so, really honestly, based on the idea that if this young black entrepreneur doesn't even know about one of the best black success stories of all time, if that's been sort of kept from us, I think it's kind of incumbent upon me to really try to change the narrative in some sense. And so for me, the entry point of this story was really that idea about black success, black solidarity, black community. And so ultimately, I wrote an article about Greenwood, and then later I ended up selling a book project, and I actually ended up quitting my job as a journalist, making a Black Country playlist and moving west to Tulsa, where I still live right now.
Making a Black Country playlist?
Oh, yeah, I know a lot about Black Country. Before Beyonce, I learned
before
a lot about—
Before Cowboy Carter.
Yes, before Cowboy Carter, I was on the train. So Tina Turner has a Black Country album called Tina Turner Turns the Country On. Everybody should check it out for sure.
Are we just going to have a diversion into a whole black country review here? Victor Lukerson is our guest. The book is available now. And the event tomorrow at the public library, 11 a.m., is free. It's open to the public. It's a chance to hear from the author. And frankly, I do wonder when you travel, as you have now for much of the past year for these book events, in one sense, I think you must be meeting people all the time who are, like Tom Hanks said, I had no idea. But I also wonder if it's a self-selecting group who comes out to book events, and do they mostly know already? I mean, what's the mix of what you're experiencing?
It's certainly a mixture. You know, I think, especially when I'm sort of in the Northeast, it's much less known. You know, I spoke at the College of the Holy Cross last semester, and very few of those students had any kind of awareness of the race massacre. But, you know, I also spoke at the University of Kentucky just a few weeks ago, and I always ask, you know, who's heard of this? And a lot of times, college students are still not learning about this in school today. And so for me, that was kind of a wake-up call. You know, I've been so immersed in this story for the last several years, and there's been so many national flashpoints. President Trump visited Tulsa in 2020. The Watchmen TV show captured Tulsa on HBO. And so I had this sense that everybody kind of knew the story. But when you really travel and talk to folks, you realize that there's a lot of folks like Tom Hanks who still have no idea about what happened in Tulsa.
I mean, the most powerful part of that clip to me is just the first lines where he says, you know, I was reading about 100-plus-year-old survivors of the Tulsa Massacre, and I thought, what's the Tulsa Massacre? Wrapped up in this, there are threads that your book carries that we're going to talk about here, is the question of who gets to write the narrative and what that story is, from journalists to educators to government. And that was going on before Tulsa, before the Tulsa Massacre, in literally in the local press's descriptions of lynching as sometimes appropriate, as you write. But now let's just answer the question that Tom Hanks had. Why do you think people like me, I didn't learn about this in school. Why? Why do you think so?
You know, I think the Tulsa Massacre disrupts a lot of ideas about American progress. When you're in school, part of what you learn is that America came from a challenging place and kind of gets better over time. You know, we're a country that's always supposed to be improving on itself, finding ways to be more inclusive, more welcoming, a place for greater and greater opportunity. But when you realize that there was this place of great black opportunity in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that black folks were working hard, getting good jobs, building good businesses, and it was all destroyed due to racism, due to anger, due to hate, it really kind of disrupts this idea that America's always improving. And it's also important to understand that Tulsa wasn't unique. There were, in fact, race massacres and race riots across the United States in that same era around 1921. In 1919, there were so many race riots that it was called the Red Summer. And so this was happening across the United States at that time. And so that's actually a moment of retrenchment in the American project. And I think that's kind of a dangerous idea to plant in young people's minds, the idea that America isn't always going to get better. It's not always going to be improving. There might be some instance where you have to, like, fight for your rights, fight for what you want. And so I think that mentality or that paradigm is part of why a lot of us never learned about this in school.
When it comes to the survivors now, 109 and 100, I think they're both 109
That's
now.
Correct. That's correct.
109 years old. We lost one of the three remaining survivors last year. Their lawsuit, which my understanding is the Oklahoma Supreme Court is at least going to hear the appeal or could hear the appeal.
They just heard it. I was there, actually.
Okay.
This week.
Because a judge last year dismissed this case. Did we get a reasoning from the judge on why?
Yeah, so in 2020, three living survivors of the race massacre and several descendants filed this lawsuit seeking reparations. Over the course of time, the case has kind of been whittled down slowly by the same judge. So initially, the judge said all the descendants were dismissed from the case. You had to have actually experienced the massacre to be part of it. Last year, one of the survivors, Hughes Manelis, passed away. So there's two living survivors. And in the judge's decision, she essentially said that sort of the scope of the remedy was sort of beyond what the courts could do. You know, it's almost like what happened to Greenwood is too vast for the courts to directly address in any kind of way. And so we're kind of in this catch-22 situation because, for example, the city of Tulsa, who opposes this lawsuit, they argue that the legislature is the group that should maybe be solving these issues for Greenwood survivors and descendants. However, the legislature opposes all kinds of reparations laws that have been pushed forward by Greenwood legislators. And so there's sort of this sort of like passing the buck scenario going on where every sort of branch of the government is saying it's somebody else's responsibility to deal with this.
Yeah, a mayor of Tulsa had said that it's appropriate to apologize to the living survivors, but he would not support cash payments. He said it would be unfair to tax people who weren't alive when the massacre happened. What do you make of that?
You know, I think that this idea about individual responsibility is a little bit of a red herring. I always try to think about things in terms of institutions when you think about the Tulsa race massacre. So let's not really even think about like this white mob, these random white men with guns. Let's think about the Tulsa Police Department, which deputized members of this mob specifically, even handing out guns and badges to specific people and giving instructions to go out and kill black people. This is all cited and documented in various records, and it's in my book. And so the Tulsa Police Department still exists as an institution and can be held liable for what happened at that time. I wrote an article for Time Magazine recently about the Rosewood Massacre, which is a similar act of racial violence in 1923 in Rosewood, Florida. And in the 1990s, those survivors actually received reparations from the Florida State Legislature. Why? Because the Florida government had, in 1923, failed to protect its citizens who had been destroyed by this racial violence. And so there is certainly precedent, certainly an argument to say that if an institution still exists today and it failed its citizens in that time period, we can find routes towards recompense.
What do you expect to happen with the Supreme Court of Oklahoma?
So it was really an interesting hearing to go to. I had never been to any kind of Supreme Court hearing before. And I was really struck by the fact that the justices were kind of, honestly, kind of open and questioning the dismissal of the case. One judge, in fact, when the city attorney was presenting, sort of openly asked, like, why do you think the judge dismissed this case? Don't you think it's a little bit ridiculous? He said something to that effect. Another judge said that she thought it was shameful that she had never learned about this in school, kind of giving a similar quote to Tom Hanks, to be honest with you. And so I think there's certainly a chance that the judges will undo this dismissal. But all that means is that it's going to go back to a trial court. So we're actually still very, very far from ending the route. You know, we still have to go through a trial, have discovery, and then the burden of proof will be on the survivors and their attorneys to convince some judge in Oklahoma that they do deserve reparations.
Mike in Rochester, I'll take your call in just a second. Let me just close the point on where the current lawsuit and litigation is. Do you, Victor, see this the way that some of the survivors over the years have described the need for some kind of symbolic justice? I mean, this is 103 years after the massacre, only two living survivors now, and I don't know what a reparation number would look like, but I wonder if it is less about the number and more about the symbolic act of it, or how do you see it?
Sure. Well, I think we have plenty of symbols already in Tulsa. We have museums, we have plaques, we have history centers. There are quite a few symbols there that will tell you what happened in Greenwood. I think that what's needed is some kind of material justice, not only that looks towards, I think, providing for those folks who survived, but also for providing pathways towards economic freedom for the descendants of those people. You know, in Florida, for example, there is a reparation scholarship for the descendants of the Rosewood Massacre. There's a scholarship in Oklahoma, too, but it's very limited in who it's offered to. And so I think maybe finding chances to not only provide funding or reparations for these survivors, but also funding for scholarships, funding for black businesses in Greenwood. There are a lot of different routes you can go, I think, to achieve justice. The main thing is that I think the city leaders and other folks whose institutions played a role in this destruction have to be willing to come to the table.
Let me take a phone call from Mike in Rochester. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hey, nice to hear you all. Hey, I play jazz trumpet. I'm a local jazz trumpet player and teacher around town. I played with someone named Hal Singer, a survivor of the race riot. He was 2 years old. He was born in 1919. His name was Hal Cornbread Singer. He had a hit in 1948. And I heard him in England in 1979. I didn't meet him then. Well, I shook his hand. But I was in Lisbon in 81 for a couple months teaching and played a couple gigs with him. His name was Hal Singer, Hal Cornbread Singer, and he died maybe 3 or 4 years ago at 100. So you could look him up.
Did you talk to him? Mike, did you have conversations with him at all about 1921?
He was one of the angriest people I ever met. He did not, he was a bitter fellow.
Understandably so, right?
Yeah. He was a bitter fellow. And I just remember out of the blue, he'd say things like, I walked into a church and they kicked me out because I'm black, so he was really, oof, yeah, we didn't talk much. The school I was teaching for kind of put us together for a concert or two. And so he came down from Paris to Lisbon. He was an expatriate from, I just looked on Wikipedia, maybe the early 60s. He was on tour with a band and just stayed in Paris for the rest of his life.
Thank you, Mike. I mean, I guess bitterness would be a natural outflow of being a survivor.
Yeah, there's a chapter in my book after the massacre called The Myth of an Impervious People. I think that sometimes black folks can be expected to be purely resilient, sort of survive every obstacle America throws at us, and sort of like a lesson in resilience for all Americans often. But I think we have to acknowledge that trauma does leave damage to people, you know? And so that story about Hal Singer makes sense when you think about the trauma folks have inherited and the fact that no institution has really provided any kind of recompense. I also wanted to mention on Hal Singer, actually, that Hal Singer was actually going to be part of this lawsuit. Right, just a few weeks before the lawsuit was announced in September 2020, he passed away. And so you really think about sort of the scope of all the folks who were impacted, the fact that there are only two people left. It really puts, I think, a lot of urgency on this case to really, for Tulsa judges, for the city of Tulsa to actually do something before these folks pass away.
We're talking to Victor Lukerson, who is a journalist and the author of the book Built from the Fire, The Epic Story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street. This is a book that has ended up on a lot of must-read lists, came out about a year ago, and Victor is in Rochester, was visiting students at RIT this morning. He's got an event tomorrow at 11 o'clock, a free public event at the Rochester Public Library on South Avenue, and I know they would like to see you there. Listeners, I would like to hear from you if these stories that you're hearing this hour are new or not to you, and maybe where you first encountered the story of Tulsa, if you have encountered it at all until this book. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. In our second half hour, we're going to talk more about some of these intensely personal stories, the way people and families were affected, and what Victor has chronicled in his book and elsewhere. Can I ask you to describe for listeners, for people who are encountering the story of the Tulsa massacre for the first time? I don't want to shorthand it, but I mean, May 31st, 1921, white mob attacks, burns three dozen city blocks, up to 300 people dead. But how do you describe maybe some of the motivations, how it actually, what was the spark that lit it? And then we're going to talk about the aftermath and some of the contradictions and from the white community's reaction and the efforts to rebuild, et cetera.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of factors at play. Sort of in the broadest sense, politically, Oklahoma was a state that really embraced Jim Crow and didn't have to. When Oklahoma became a state in 1907, segregated train cars was the very first law. So you have to think about being in this place that was already dehumanizing black folks as a matter of policy from its inception. In 1921, a young black man named Dick Rowland was working in downtown Tulsa in a white space. He wanted to go to the bathroom in a department store. He gets on an elevator with a white attendant named Sarah Page. On this elevator, the elevator lurches, and Dick Rowland accidentally steps on Sarah Page's foot or grabs her arm. Sarah Page screams, and an attendant in the department store sees all this happening. Dick Rowland ultimately gets arrested on a false rape charge. And critically, even though all this stuff happened, we still might have avoided this outcome. However, the Tulsa White Press published a very incendiary article that is even exaggerated beyond what was in the police report. So they're talking about Dick Rowland scratching at Sarah Page's face, tearing at her clothes, making him into this black brute, truly. And so when this article was published in the Tulsa Tribune, a lot of white folks got really riled up in Tulsa on May 31st. And so a white mob was formed to go try to remove Dick Rowland from the county jail, but they weren't prepared for the fact that a bunch of black soldiers, black war veterans, also came there to try to defend Rowland. And so on that night, a black man and a white man fought over a gun at the courthouse. A gunshot went off. It was sort of chaos in the streets, essentially. And the next morning, as punishment to black people for attempting to defend one of their own, an armed mob of 5,000 white people with torches, guns, and kerosene invaded the Greenwood District. As you said, they destroyed more than 35 square blocks, more than 1,200 structures, killed up to 300 people. For me, one of the most striking facts I discovered was the fact that there were actually 6 stillborn babies in Greenwood during the massacre. And so you really come to understand that Greenwood lost its past when this all unfolded, but it also lost its future in a lot of ways.
And Sarah texts, listening, Sarah emails to say during the story that you're relating, says, sounds to me like there are some similarities to the Emmett Till case. Do you see that
Sure. Yeah? There's definitely a pattern when you look at cases of racial violence against black men, of this sort of paranoia about relationships between black men and white women, sexual relations. That's a very consistent. I mentioned the Rosewood massacre earlier in Florida, and that was also precipitated by a white woman accusing a black man of rape. And so I think that factor often is part of the powder keg that sets off these kinds of incidents of vicious racial violence.
And of course, as you say, the exaggeration and the caricature is part of the slur. It's part of the effort to propagandize and maybe stoke fear.
Yeah, and I think to dehumanize and fear, especially paranoia, was a huge factor in the race massacre. Some white folks in Tulsa had this fear about a sort of a Negro uprising, which I think maybe comes a little bit from guilt, you know, some sense that all this wrong we've done is going to come back on us one day, and so we need to be ready. And so there really was a very sincere fear that black folks are going to arm themselves and invade white Tulsa. And this fear plays out on the night of the massacre, because when the Tulsa police is trying to quote-unquote restore order, their entire goal is to protect white property and white life. They have no concern about what might happen in Greenwood. And so you kind of see that paranoia that's part of the culture of white Tulsa playing out in the decisions the institutions are making about who they're going to protect and who they're going to let become destroyed.
Let me grab a call. A teacher in Spencerport, John, I think teaches in Brockport. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call. It sounds like a great book I've got to go get, but I just wanted to, you were talking about people not learning this in school. And I have been teaching for about 20 years, social studies for about 20 years. And it was when we got the New York State framework about 10, 15 years ago, the And it's called the Tulsa Race Riots there. And, of course, we've changed that name since to the Tulsa Massacre. But it has been in the New York State framework. But it's one of those things that gets marginalized because of time, because of all sorts of issues of not including marginalized folks and all different kinds of people in the story of American history. But I think particularly after the Black Lives Matter movement and in 2020, I think that social studies teachers got a lot better about making sure we're telling a more complete story. And so I do think it is, you will have people.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections at Connections, we are going to be talking.
I'm hearing a promo there. There we go.
Hey, that must have been my fault.
No, that's all right. Hey, John, when you talk about the way teachers are teaching and what they are including, is there pushback from parents that you hear?
There is some. We're lucky we don't have – I personally have not experienced that very often. If those things ever come up, it's usually productive conversation. Because we're trying to help their kids, one, think for themselves, and two, have a more complete view of American history. And I think most people can understand that. And we're working from facts. I mean, you know, a lot of the facts that your guest has talked about, you know, people aren't aware, and these are things you can find primary sources on these things, which you want kids to work with anyway. So,
yeah, John, I appreciate that that background. What do you make of that, Victor?
Yeah, you know, I've talked to a lot of teachers who are concerned about how they can teach this history. And honestly, one thing I often say is, hey, you don't have to teach my book. You can teach a primary source. There's a book called Events of the Tulsa Disaster, published by a black woman named Mary Jones Parrish in 1923. Mary Jones Parrish survived the race massacre. And in the days afterwards, she interviewed lots of other black survivors of the massacre and took down their words verbatim. And so I think it's much harder to argue with firsthand accounts from people who lived through that. This book was recently republished, actually, just a couple of years ago. And so often I say, hey, if you're worried about somebody saying, oh, Victor, who's from like the mainstream media playing his games, why don't you just get an actual primary source that folks can read and learn from?
John, before I let you go, can I ask you one other question?
Sure.
I'm thinking about some of the argument that you hear in states like Oklahoma, literally from the superintendent of education when he was first installed, and saying that I think Walters was saying that, you know, he's not even sure it's appropriate to teach this in schools. Certainly, folks in Florida and other states have weighed in a lot on curriculum. And one of the reasons that we see for this hesitation to even teach, whether it's Tulsa or so many other aspects of history, is, well, we have to raise kids to, we don't want to raise kids to hate this country. We don't want to raise kids to hate themselves, et cetera. And I confess, so my bias is I find that tremendously misguided and even dangerous. I think a great country can grapple with its own past and history, and frankly must, if it wants to live up or come even close to its founding ideals, of which we have not reached. So that's my bias. I'll put that on the table. But I want to ask you as a teacher, if you've encountered any students who maybe raise some of those ideas themselves, or is that mostly a parental concern or a politician concern, and maybe how you would navigate that?
Well, and again, I can only speak for myself.
Sure.
But my experience is, you know what, when that stuff kind of comes up, kids look incredulous. They're like, well, of course we want to learn this. Or, you know, like the issue like in Florida, don't teach things that make kids feel bad about themselves or or society. And I think, no, I'm talking about middle school, 12, 13, 14 year old kids. And they'll go, that seems like that doesn't make sense to them. They do want to know. To them, you know, no matter what, they're starting to develop their political identities, which is kind of neat to watch. And of course, a lot of times they pair it with their parents or and I always tell them, I don't want you to, you know, it doesn't matter what I think. What do you think? And so I guess my point is, I think it's kids, at least my experience, all different kinds of kids, they want to understand the world. And they appreciate when we respect them enough to say, here, like the primary sources, again, that your guest referenced, we want to put those things in front of you. And you decide what they mean. Ask good questions. That's what we want to do.
John, much love to you. Thank you for the phone call. Victor, you want to add to some of that?
Yeah. I'm not a teacher like John, but I did have an interesting experience with mentorship working on this project. So I have a teenage cousin named Stanley, and Stanley lives in Alabama. I'm from Alabama, too. And when Stanley was 14 years old, I hired him to be a research assistant on my book with me, actually. And so Stanley actually spent a lot of time learning about the race massacre. And he wasn't doing like kids' work. He was reading like academic text about the race massacre. He had me look through some of the lawsuits that race massacre survivors filed in 1923. He read books about black soldiers during World War I and World War II, analyzed newspapers. He really got a full sense of what had happened in Greenwood, which he knew nothing about at his school. So let's fast forward to Stanley was a senior in high school last year. And I interviewed Stanley about his experiences, you know. And so, you know, was Stanley resentful of America, having heard about this horrific stuff that happened to black folks? No, he actually felt like it was more important to become an engaged citizen, you know. He had a better sense of the arc of this country. He had a better sense of, you know, what he might be up against as a black person, but it actually made him more motivated. And also he was so inspired, he told me, by the resilience of Greenwood. You know, the fact that these folks were able to rebuild after the race massacre. And so for my cousin Stanley, at least, the experience of learning about this actually made him want to be a more engaged citizen, not someone who resented America.
If you're on the phone, we're going to try to squeeze in as many calls as we can this hour. Victor Lukerson, you have sparked a conversation in this community. The book is called Built from the Fire, The Epic Story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street, 100 years in the neighborhood that refused to be erased. Victor's book is not only available now, he is in Rochester. He was talking to RIT students this morning, and he is going to have an event tomorrow at 11 a.m. at the Rochester Public Library on South Avenue. It's a free event, and I know they would love to see you there. When we come back from this break, we will work in more of your phone calls. I want to talk to Victor more about some of his research and the work that he's done over the years to really understand the personal story and the way people were impacted by the massacre. You might have encountered this story as the Tulsa race riots. You heard John mention that. That's the first time I ever heard about it. That was the term. The term really is the massacre. I want to ask Victor about that as well. Much more with the author on the other side of this only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with members of the indigenous community about how they are marking Monday's total solar eclipse. There are events coming up Sunday and Monday. We'll tell you about what's happening this weekend, all the way leading up to totality on Monday, from an indigenous perspective. Scientists, educators, cultural leaders, and more. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Rick writes to the program and says, Evan, your guest makes a good point noting how often racial violence is incited by claims of sexual impropriety of blacks against white women. What does your guest think about the fact that Donald Trump has repeatedly asserted that Mexican migrants to the United States are rapists? Does your guest believe that that language can prompt similar violence against immigrants?
Yeah, you know, one thing I really came to understand in doing the research about Tulsa is that rhetoric can lead to violence quite directly. I think that the dehumanizing language is often the thing that precipitates violence or creates an opening for violence to be rationalized, you know? So certainly many things that Donald Trump has said, including denigrating Mexicans, fits within that purview. You know, I think that when you look back at the case in Tulsa, I think about sort of like, almost like Donald Trump on Twitter, but sort of that day-to-day dehumanization. It's not always about sort of like the big controversial statement. It's about sort of creating a mentality over time that says that black people are lesser, some group is lesser. And that was certainly what was going on in the white press in Tulsa before 1921.
Well, I think you have written that maybe a decade or so before the Tulsa massacre in 1921, there was a lynching in Wagoner, and the press had described lynchings as occasionally appropriate, if I'm remembering correctly, or some kind of language that was softening. You want to describe
that? Yeah, exactly. So before the race massacre in Oklahoma, lynchings were getting increasingly widespread, particularly lynchings of black people. And so quite often when these murders would happen, the white press would, you know, basically praise them. So a case in Wagoner, Oklahoma, a black woman named Marie Scott was lynched and hanged in front of a store on Main Street. And so in the white press in this town of Wagoner, the press did say that they thought lynching could have a peaceful and helpful appearance. Meanwhile, in Tulsa, in the black press, they're saying that actually lynching has no place. It doesn't matter what Marie Scott was accused of. It actually doesn't matter what Marie Scott's race is even. This is about white and black and any kind of folks being able to believe in the rule of law. And so you kind of saw the white press honestly endorsing the collapse of law, while it was the black press that was saying that everyone deserves a right to some kind of avenue toward justice.
That, you know, that's a story of one incident, but it's also a story of a mentality of how the press and the power holders are viewing the wielding of power, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that when you combine that embrace of vigilante violence with the white press in Tulsa saying, hey, this black man's raped this white woman, you can almost kind of see the gears turning of sort of what's being advocated for by sort of creating these false narratives about black sexuality and black brutality.
Before I come back to phone calls, there's a couple other points I want to hit with Victor Lukerson. And this is a bit of a scattered interview, but there's so much here, and I'm grateful for your time, so thank you for making it. You have talked about some of the echoes you see in not just the event in Tulsa, the massacre in Tulsa and January 6th, but also the way that those events are talked about by people who are trying to sort of minimize the perpetrators. Can you describe that?
Sure. So I was knee deep in my book in Tulsa on January 6th of 2021. And, you know, like everybody sort of watching what was unfolding at the Capitol on the TV. And my very first thought was, wow, this is just like what I'm writing about that happened in Tulsa in 1921. And so, you know, I wrote a piece for The New Yorker called Living in the Age of the White Mob. And really trying to draw those parallels about how some of the political upheaval we're experiencing right now is so similar to what was going on in Tulsa in 21 and during the Red Summer. And so one of the points I brought up in the piece was that right after January 6th, we saw this effort by President Trump and others to sort of try to cast the folks who had come to the Capitol as sort of the riffraff of our society, these folks who were lower class, that kind of thing, when in fact many of them were middle or upper class that we found out through the various trials and what have you. I mean, we rewind the clock back to Tulsa in 21. Again, the white power structure after the massacre said, hey, this was actually a battle between, like, low-class Negroes and low-class whites. But look at some of the photos. You'll see men in suits. You see men in uniform. We know for a fact that members of the Klan in Tulsa were not sort of white trash. They were judges. They were lawyers. They were people who held the highest seats of power in that community. And so I think there's sort of a – I think it's really important to understand that sometimes, quite often, in fact, a racist structure isn't just about people burning crosses or doing sort of like individual evil deeds. It's often a boys club or a power structure that's trying to exert its authority over the way that all of us live.
And then the question of how linear a recovery can be and how it's impossible just for a community like Greenwood just to bounce back on a perfect linear line in the same way that our guest has described, you know, this a movement toward justice is not necessarily linear. It is not necessarily inevitable. And some of those echoes, I was saying to Victor before the program, that I felt from his book that there are conflicting ideas of even how the white power holders in Tulsa described the massacre itself, whether at times, depending on who their audience was it something they blamed on black people? Was it something they waved away or minimized? And then you had this event 4 years after the massacre. I'm reading from your book now that you said Tulsa's white leaders also made a pointed effort to put on a good show for an event that had come to town. Many of them attended the Business League's meeting's opening ceremony, the same location that had served as a detention camp during the massacre. And Tulsa Mayor Herman Neublock, a former city commissioner who had approved the fire ordinance that nearly prevented Greenwood's reconstruction, was one of the event's keynote speakers. He was later identified as a member of the Klan, but he was preaching the gospel of racial harmony during this event. He says, there will never be any more racial friction in Tulsa, he promised black visitors. There's so much dissonance in that paragraph. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was a challenge for me as a journalist to sort of try to wrap my mind around some of this doublespeak that's happening. I think, for one thing, I think it's an assertion of power. You know, we've put this rebellion, quote-unquote, down, and we don't need to worry about the black folks sort of doing that kind of thing again. So on one hand, I see that kind of thing happening in a quote like that. But I also see Tulsa leaders were very image conscious at the time. And so they're, I think them trying to uphold a symbol of Tulsa as a place of legality, of a place of order, that was very, very vital to them keeping their oil business going and all this kind of stuff. And so I think sort of on the white side of things, it's pretty easy to understand why there would have been so much effort to paper over this. You know, that period of the mid-1920s was actually when the active forgetting began very, very aggressively about the race massacre.
A note from Jennifer says, glad you're interviewing Victor Lukerson. He's getting a tour tomorrow from elders and youth of the Clarissa Uprooted exhibit that is now downtown. And we are hoping that people will go from his talk and come across the street to visit the exhibit afterward to learn about Rochester's version of Black Wall Street. The elders often say, thank God it wasn't a massacre in Rochester, but like other places in the country, our systems found a way to dismantle and erase successful black communities. And we've talked about Clarissa Uprooted on this program before. The exhibit that we're talking about is open Wednesdays and Saturday afternoons for now. If you haven't seen it, it is a powerful one to see. I know Victor's going to have a chance tomorrow, I think.
Yeah, I'm excited to see that. And I'm really excited because when I wrote this book, I was really hoping that folks would see parallels to their own communities. I always try to say that what happened in Greenwood wasn't unique at any step. There was racial violence happening across the United States in that era of 21, like I said, but there was also a lot of black success going on in places like Greenwood, here in Rochester and elsewhere. So I really hope that when folks dive into the book, they're able to kind of draw those parallels to their own community story.
You also have done a lot of work to understand the human toll and impact. I mentioned people like Ed Goodwin. The image of a teenager hiding in a bathtub during a massacre is heartbreaking. Mm. But what do you want to let our listeners know about, before they pick up your book, about the importance of understanding these very human stories and the century after this massacre, the effort to remember, to rebuild, not to be cliche, but to literally rise from the ashes, and that hasn't always been easy or perfect.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes in this country, there's a tendency to reduce black people to symbols. I have a newsletter that I write. I wrote a column called Noble Negroes one time, kind of talking about how oftentimes all the edges of a black person get sanded off because we have to be this perfect symbol in order to be treated as a valid human experience worth studying or remembering. And so in this book, I really wanted to be able to draw these people who are from Greenwood as fully lived people, people with flaws, people with aspirations, people with loves, people with rivalries. And so when you read the book, you really get embedded into this world and kind of come to understand them as humans. And hopefully when you understand them as people, you also come to understand their political arguments, right? Once you understand what the folks have been through in Greenwood, from the race massacre to redlining to destruction via highways to gentrification right now, I think it becomes a lot easier to understand why there's a lawsuit going on right now in Oklahoma seeking reparations. And so I hope when people dive into the story, they really sort of get that human perspective first before they even sort of start asking the political questions. I think you kind of have to sort of empathize with somebody as a person before you're willing to sort of back them as an ally.
All right, let me get back to more of your feedback. And Roy in Rochester has been waiting. Hi, Roy. Go ahead.
Yes, Evan. Sounds like a very interesting book. I just remember school at another time and another zeitgeist that, as I found it, my major textbooks by Garrity and others essentially were done by the publishers on the specifications of Texas school boards because they bought the most. But on the other hand about history, I was wondering what the author had with W.E.B. Du Bois and The Crisis. How did they cover this?
Yeah, so Du Bois actually visited Greenwood a few years after the race massacre. And he really had this really amazing quote that I love that's in the book. He said that the neighborhood is impudent and noisy, but it believes in itself. And so Du Bois is one of those people who actually really celebrated Greenwood's comeback, their ability to sort of rise from the ashes, so to speak. But also, of course, he was very outspoken against racial violence. And so, you know, I think he sort of captured what I try to do in my book, which is to be able to sort of celebrate the resilience and the ingenuity of these folks without losing sight of the fact that, they were wrong through this destruction and that wrong has still not been righted today.
Thank you, Roy. Marcia in Walworth called in to thank the program for talking about this. She says she's well-educated, a student of history, 77 years old, and never knew about the Tulsa Massacre until just a few years ago. Might have heard about it described as the Tulsa Race Riots. The accurate term is the Tulsa Massacre. You want to talk a little bit about that distinction?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So right when I started doing this reporting in 2018, that's around when the Tulsa World, the current newspaper in Tulsa, actually switched their nomenclature from riot to massacre. And this is like a big kind of debate that had been kind of percolating in Tulsa for a long time. So on one hand, some people might say, what's the big deal? They kind of mean the same thing. They really don't. You know, a riot implies an even-handed fight between two different groups, in this case, black folks and white folks, whereas a massacre is more accurately describes what happened, which is a wholesale destruction. And sort of beyond just being accurate, there's also legal implications to this. After the race massacre happened, a lot of Greenwood property owners had fire insurance claims, and the insurance companies refused to give payouts because they actually had riot exclusion clauses that said if a riot occurs that destroys your property, you get nothing. And so this entire narrative of an even-handed fight between black people and white people ultimately gives the fire insurance companies the ability to absolve themselves of any responsibility. And so this terminology is not only about being accurate, it also has a lot of legal implications for who gets to receive any kind of recompense for what happened.
Mark wrote in to ask, did any families or individuals get their property back? And how is Greenwood doing today?
So after the race massacre, the neighborhood was rebuilt. There was a really important moment in the months afterwards where white real estate men tried to buy out the neighborhood, but Greenwood folks refused to sell. And so that was really inspiring to me to kind of see that level of sort of holding strong on their block. Unfortunately, when you fast forward to the 60s and 70s, a lot of Greenwood folks did lose their homes. Not to a mob, but to urban policy. You know, urban renewal policies ultimately ended up hoovering up about 200 acres of land in and around Greenwood. And a lot of that land today is actually still empty. And so Greenwood does have a small number of black-owned businesses, but some of the land is now used for a college campus for Oklahoma State. Some of the land is used for a baseball stadium, which is not even attended by many of the black folks who are from Greenwood. And a lot of it's just empty, too. And so when I first went there, that was actually one of the most striking things to me, to drive through this neighborhood where I'd heard about all this black success, all this black excellence, and to see just empty land. And the idea that the powers that be in Tulsa would rather see something empty there than black folks, it's kind of disquieting in a different way than the big stadium. You know what I mean?
And let me grab Joel in Rochester on the phone, finish up the hour. Hi, Joel, go ahead.
Wanted to connect to Rochester more deeply. I don't know if Olivia Hooker has been mentioned, but she's a huge player in the effort to sue the city and so forth. She's got a PhD in psychology from the University of Rochester. She's the first black woman to serve in the Coast Guard, to enlist and serve in active duty in the Coast Guard, and is in fact a station named after her. So if we could connect to that Rochester piece and see what your guest has to say about Olivia Hooker to end the show, that would be great.
So Olivia Hooker's father, S.D. Hooker, was a very prominent entrepreneur in Greenwood. He owned like a dry goods store and a lot of other successful businesses. And Olivia Hooker was one of the major sort of advocates for Greenwood in the last 10 years or so. And so if anybody looks up her name, you'll find a lot of articles where she's talking about her own experiences. Unfortunately, Ms. Hooker passed away a few years ago, so she's not part of this lawsuit or the current pursuit of justice. But certainly I think she was one of those people who was reminding people about what happened in Tulsa over the last couple of decades.
Andrea in Pittsford calls in to say she is uplifted that we are talking about this topic. She is from Elaine, Arkansas, and says before the Tulsa massacre, there was the Elaine massacre in 1919. She says there's been a continued legacy of not talking about these events. She's glad they are now being discussed.
Yeah, I mentioned the Elaine massacre in my book. And I also think it's important. The Elaine issue is actually a labor issue. A lot of black laborers were seeking better wages, which ultimately sort of snowballs into this destruction of their community. And so I think there's often an economic or political valence to these race riots and massacres, in addition to the issues involving sexual relations. I mean, Greenwood's case, there were black folks in Greenwood who were trying to run for political office, who were advocating for the Democrats in the black press. And these are actually the specific folks who were seeking political power, who are ultimately charged with inciting the race riot. These two men, A.J. Smith and J.B. Stratford, of all the folks who were sort of accused of being involved, they were charged with inciting the riot and ultimately banished from the city forever. And so you sort of have, obviously, the destruction going on physically, but there's also an effort at sort of political destruction of the black power structure that's trying to be built in that era, not only in Elaine, but also in Tulsa and many other places.
Last minute here, we've been talking to Victor Lukerson about his book. Is there a difference generally that when you encounter white readers who never knew the story versus when you talk to black readers who never knew the story of Tulsa?
Oh, yes. There's a very clear difference to me. I think white readers are kind of on the Tom Hanks lane. How do I know about this horrible thing that happened? It's so horrible. Everything's so horrible. Black readers are more interested in Greenwood's success in the daily life of Greenwood and just that breathe in, breathe out moment. They see that they see their own families in the stories I write about black life in Tulsa. And so I think for white people, there's sort of this need to be educated about the violence, but black folks kind of expect it or kind of know about it intuitively. And so I think they're more interested in what are the pathways towards success, towards strategizing around that violence. So, you know, I think that's one reason I wrote the book the way I did was so that people could sort of see that duality, right? Greenwood was a place that suffered this horrific violence, but it's also a place that came back and is still fighting. And so I always try to emphasize the fact that it's a place of fighters, and they continue the fight today.
Undoubtedly, this book is going to be taught in a lot of classrooms, but it's going to be one of the important works as we understand the massacre of 1921 in Tulsa going forward. It is called Built from the Fire, the epic story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street, 100 years in the neighborhood that refused to be erased. It is available now. Among many other accolades, one of the New York Times notable books of 2023. Victor is in Rochester tomorrow, 11 a.m., the Rochester Public Library for a free event open to the public. I know they'd love to see you there. We're grateful for your time. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Really enjoyed it.
Victor Lukerson, Built from the Fire. More connections coming up in a moment.